If you're into sports, then it's your favorite time of the year, NCAA March Madness. So many games, you never know what's going to happen. That's why you need to be ready for whatever the next round brings. There's a 16-1 upset. If a 9 seed makes the Final Four, you better make sure your fridge isn't empty at halftime. Swing by Walmart before every round and stock up on Coca-Cola, Coke Zero Sugar, and Powerade. I prefer Powerade Zero, personally. Before the next game tips off, NCAA March Madness isn't just one game, it's a whole tournament. Make sure you're ready. Refresh every round by heading to Walmart to pick up Coca-Cola, Coke Zero Sugar, and Powerade. Well, it's been long overdue, especially with the way the Utah Jazz have been playing of late, have winners of 19 of 21 before a kind of odd loss to the Hawks last night, but we'll, or maybe not odd, as our guest may tell us, but David Locke, the president, founder of the Locked On podcast network, would you say? And of course, Utah Jazz radio man as well.
I think I can go with founder. That's accurate. And if I have given myself the title as president, it seems pretty arrogant, so we'll probably pass on that. But I don't know what my title is right now of the Locked On podcast network. The guys are doing incredible work. I'm pretty excited about where we're heading and what's going on with it, and all the hosts have really been amazing, so I'm excited. I don't know what title I get for it though, so I might have to just stay with founder. That one I can't deny.
David has a national NBA podcast, of course, Locked On NBA, that he's on a couple times a week, and then they've actually just gone to 5 days a week of late. And actually I most recommend them probably for fantasy, Locked On Fantasy, Josh Lloyd. I'm not super into fantasy, but I am told, and the few times I've listened to it and been on there, I've been really impressed with his level of knowledge as well. So I want to talk a little bit, just we'll get to the Jazz obviously at the end here, but you watch a lot of NBA games. You're in a little bit different of a position than some of us because you're right there with the team a lot of the time. You've got access to some of the stuff that we don't have access to. But so I want to ask you, over the course of the season, like, what have you learned about basketball this year?
So it's funny, you sent me an outline and I had one answer, and now by the time you ask me the question in person, I have another, which probably is a large statement in my brain. I think it's interesting how many things are being done for the course of 82 games, or for the course of the well-being of the franchise, the big picture, whereas, you know, most fans are passionately involved in each night, you know. And I think I'll see things that the coach does, and if it doesn't make a lot of sense, you know, if there's analytics that show it otherwise, or why would he possibly be doing that? I think from my point of view, I've really gotten past the point, none of these guys are idiots. In fact, they're the exact opposite. The coaches in this league are incredible. And so there's a reason. And then you've got, I think that's the thing you got to decipher is, so why is this guy's defensive rating is 111 back out there again? And there probably is some sort of reason. And, you know, I think coaches are often making moves to hold a locker room together. I think coaches are making moves to hope that, realizing that, wow, this guy's 2 of his last 24 from three, but we're in game 34 of the season. And you know what? I'm going to need him at game 75. So I just cannot banish him to the end of the bench. And I think that there's a lot more of that that goes on in regards to how a team is massaged through a season than I think most people realize.
Anything else that falls into that category for you other than player usage seems like the one that you alluded to there, but anything else that you see that's kind of more regular season, overall health of the franchise stuff that's been going on?
Oh, I mean, I also think there's the stuff where, I'll use a football analogy. So there's like that quarterback who the blitz comes and he's supposed to hit his hot receiver on the right side, and instead he throws a bomb into double coverage that's complete for a 72-yard touchdown, and the fans love it, but the coach is sitting there saying, wait a sec, he made the wrong read, and that's going to be intercepted most of the time. How can I ever trust this quarterback? And then that quarterback doesn't play, and everyone can't figure out why. There's some of that that goes on as well, I think, would be the other thing, where, you know, maybe somebody hit a jumper on the right wing, but he busted the play to do it, and if the play's not working, you know, and those kind of things. I think there's a little bit more of that that goes on as well in this league, and I think a lot of fans realize where somebody may not be getting getting time because they're massaging things to get through portions of the season. And I think there's the other side is where someone's not getting time. You can't quite figure out why. Again, it's probably for subtle things that aren't entirely clear. No coach is going to come out and say, you know, well, you know, Steve Mitchell doesn't doesn't run plays correctly, and so he doesn't get to play.
Yeah, well, Rick Carlisle might say that, but I'm not sure.
Right.
I'm not sure anyone else would. When was Quinn's first year? It was 14-15, right?
Yeah.
Yes. So I remember that a common refrain from you that year was that they were actually practicing more than was optimal to win games. That they felt like practice in some ways was more important than the games was, especially because it was his first year to get his system implemented. Is that an accurate summary of kind of what the approach was that season?
There's no question that that year they were willing to fatigue players to install a culture and a system that might cost them a basketball game. No question about that.
I think anyone else is doing that. It seems like a great idea to me, especially when these teams aren't necessarily trying to win that hard anyway to begin with. You know, I mean, if you look at a team like the Suns, for example, you know, Devin Booker had these comments recently saying that, you know, we've kind of been spoiled. We've been handed things and that, you know, they really struggle to get guys to execute in games. I mean, I'm not saying they aren't doing that, but have you heard it from anyone else that anyone has tried that approach? Because it seems like a really good one to me for a young team.
I have not. I probably haven't asked either, though. So that is, you know, and I think Quinn Snyder does a lot of things that are very different than everybody else. I don't know that for a fact, just in the sense that I'm not at everybody's practice and everybody shoot around the way I have access to the Utah Jazz. But I do think Quinn is pretty unique in, sorry, that's bad English. I think Quinn is unique. Cannot put a qualifier on unique. I think Quinn's unique in his approach and his mind. And so I do think there's things he does that are different than other people.
Yeah, pretty unique is one of those ones that I say all the time, too. Because the problem is when you're trying to come up with it, like, what is a better synonym if you want to say that something rare? Like, that doesn't quite work there. So I don't really have a great synonym for if you're going to say it's pretty unique. You know, it's like trying to express that sentiment. I'm not sure of what the great way is to express that. But hopefully it'll just be one of those things that eventually become so colloquial that it gets to be proper grammar anyway. So maybe they'll catch up with us eventually.
Norma Pfeiffer, my ninth grade English teacher, was looking from above on me there, and she got me. The other one, I, by the way, on that topic that I love is when coaches say their players need more notoriety. Go look up the definition of notoriety. Basically means you rape somebody. It's basically being famous for all the wrong reasons. Like, the Austin bomber is notorious. When coaches complain that their players aren't getting enough notoriety, I'm always like, really? Interesting, because I don't think that's really what you mean.
But then you don't want to say attention, because the idea of getting attention is another thing that kind of has a negative connotation in our society. But right. Where the hell were we? Oh, yeah, so...
Recognition is the word we're looking for, I think.
So you've kind of been adamant in pushing some of the Jazz for some of the individual awards this year. But one of them, I mean, you mentioned Quinn Snyder and his slightly to pretty unique approach. Can you elaborate on that? Like, what is it that you think, I mean, maybe, and again, you know, I know you're not in to say, hey, he's doing this and nobody else isn't, but, you know, you've seen previous coaches with this organization before, you've been part of other organizations before. Like, what is it that stands out for him, you know, compared to other NBA coaches, at least that you've experienced with?
Well, without comparing him to others, I mean, his commitment to preparation is, the players know he's going to be, his for preparation, detailed shoot-arounds are just incredible. And so what both the offensive and defensive approach that this team takes to be prepared for games is at a very high level. I honestly can't say I know it's at an elite level, because I'm not at 29 other practices, but I have a hard time fathoming how somebody could be more detailed.
without blowing your cover too badly here, I mean, can you give it any kind of examples on what sort of stuff that you've been impressed by with the level of detail?
I mean, it can be anything from him knowing that if a player changes the angle in which he runs a route coming off the, you know, say a player starts on the downside in the corner, and he'll try to do something that makes that player change the route they run to, you know, to get something. There was a game, I'm going to leave some names and teams out here, but there was a game, I think this was probably 4 years ago, this was probably the first time I really was like, whoa, where he had, there was part of the team's offense was initiated by a pass to the elbow, and he had really figured out that if they didn't make the pass to the elbow, that they didn't have a set of counters, and that their offense really just broke down almost into a pure one-on-one game if they didn't get the pass to the elbow, and it was to a player that you couldn't really do damage from the elbow. So I'm guessing that every other team just allowed this pass to go to this player at the elbow because he wasn't going to hit a 15-footer and he really wasn't going to do a lot of things to bother you. And all of a sudden we came out and denied the pass to that player all night long, and this team was just an absolute zoo that night. So that one's probably, you know, as good an example if I have just with a preparation level, you know, he clearly saw something and then just watched and watched and watched and watched and watched until he realized, wow, like they don't have something there. I'm just trying to think without, you know, I got to be careful, right? This is all from stuff that goes on in shoot arounds that I'm so fortunate to have access to and learn so much from. You know, there's some of the basic right, left kind of things like that, but it's a lot more of making them change the angle by which they're doing something that will destroy the spacing, or even just, you know, hey, if you're covering this guy at this spot, make sure your hands are up because his only release passes are these two. And if your hands are up, then it's going to be enough time in the air for this guy to rotate back. I mean, so it's really pretty, I mean, at least to me, those are high level details.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think maybe even some might say that's too high level, right? And obviously they've been successful, so it's not. But I think a lot of coaches would say, well, you know, that's too granular. You know, we're just trying to get you to know that Lou Williams likes to go left every time, you know, like, and so do you think that how is he able to impart that? Because I mean, he's probably, I'm guessing, not the only coach in the NBA who might be able to tell players these things, but to actually impart it and get them to execute, to me, that is so much more of coaching. I mean, everyone could be like, oh, how could like the coach like let them do this? It's like, well, you know, it's a game of telephone. Every time you want the players to do something, you have to actually impart that knowledge to them and get them to execute it. And it seems like that is something that he really excels at.
Well, one, I think Dennis Lindsay and Quinn Snyder work together to bring in types of players who can execute what we're speaking of. So I think that's the first part of it.
Yeah.
The second part of it, I would say, is a little bit of back to where you started. There's just been an incredible commitment to building habit. And so, you know, if you can get your players to build a habit in, I'm thinking about it really defensively, but though our offensive stuff is equally as complicated. If you can build the habit, then you're able to take the next level stuff. The one thing Quinn will talk a lot about is he's used this analogy a lot. When you're driving someplace for the first time and you're on the phone, you often say, you know what, I got to go. I got to figure out where I'm going. If you're driving home, you would never do that.
Yeah.
Right? Because you've done it so many times. It's a happy. And to that, I think, is a really wonderful analogy of what his coaching is that they pound stuff and work on things so many times, so much, that it's all driving home. So then you can go to the next level stuff.
Yeah, that's really interesting. All right, so I want to take a quick break here. We'll be right back with a ton more from David Locke. I'm going to take a quick break here to tell you about Sonos and their up and running setup experience. Sonos, as you guys know already from the ads they've done before, is a far superior technology to just a Bluetooth speaker in your home, whether it's your TV, whether it's playing stuff off your phone, podcasts through your favorite podcast player like Stitcher, Spotify. You can go play Sonos directly in the Spotify app, for example. It plays it over Wi-Fi rather than over Bluetooth. The Bluetooth is just, to me, a pretty miserable technology. I had Bluetooth speakers before. I would try to connect to them. It would interrupt my phone calls. People would call me and it would try to play the call through the speaker, but then it thought that the speaker was a microphone, but it didn't have a microphone. Really a very difficult experience. No such problem with Sonos because it just plays through your home Wi-Fi. And while Sonos speakers are very easy to set up, if you don't want to bother, you can have someone do it for you for free. If you live in any metropolitan area, their up and running service will have a trained expert deliver and set up your system absolutely free. People who came for me were awesome. They found out that we didn't have quite the right equipment the first time. We needed a sound bar that could attach to my TV because it was wall mounted. So they helped me to get the right piece of equipment. Then they helped me set up the sound, which sounds absolutely amazing in my house. They actually, you take an iPhone and it listens for a series of pulses from the Sonos and can optimize the sound quality for the room. It really sounds fantastic, better than anything has a right to sound in your home, especially considering how sleek the speakers are. So the way to get started with them, go to Sonos.com and get 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotion. Use the promo code DUNC10, D-U-N-C-10, a little bit different than the normal code. This time, that's DUNC10, D-U-N-C-10, because you're getting 10% off. at Sonos.com to receive this offer. Once again, you can get 10% off any order of $2,500 or less using the promo code DUNK10 at Sonos.com. I let them know that you came from us. So one of the things that stuck out to me that I think has probably been my biggest take, and maybe this isn't necessarily an evolution that I'm recognizing so much as it is something that I'm just realizing and was always the case, but the differences between regular season and playoff basketball have really stuck out to me, whether that's because the Cavaliers have kind of, you know, maybe been the ultimate like mess around in the regular season type of team, and then they make it to the finals every year, whether it's, you know, we see so many teams now going one-on-one trying to get whoever the worst matchup is, but you know they'll do that more in the playoffs when you can really lock in on an opponent. You know, those are some of the things that make me say, hey, this is part of what makes playoff basketball so different, that if you have any weaknesses they will be exposed there, whereas on a night-to-night basis in the NBA it's harder to do that.
Yeah, I don't know if, I mean, I think as you were kind of running through it, I was listening really intently because I think you're probably got better thoughts than I do on this. I mean, the two-way player is the most common thing that we talk about all the time. I'm not entirely sure that the league is right on that, actually. Like, I'm currently at a stage where, having covered a team that nobody in the world would ever think could win 21 of 23 games, including myself, trying to figure out why and how it can happen. And that's where I am mind-wise, and that's actually making me wonder if some of these other things we've always thought to be true may not be true.
This Jazz run, what stereotypes or ideas has that run defied to you?
So the Jazz defense since January 19th when Rudy Gobert returned is 10 points above better than average in the league. And in that same time period when the Rockets won whatever in a row, their offense was 9 points above average. So the Jazz defense is the Rockets offense. So then is Rudy Gobert James Harden?
Oh, you're jumping the gun on this one. But
I have about, honestly, the Jazz winning 21 of 23 and living through it has really got my head spinning. Like, I'm playing around every night when we don't have a game, running numbers, watching games, trying to figure out what's going on, because nobody, like the point guard on this team is Ricky Rubio. The Jazz win their next game, he'll win the most games he's ever won in his regular season. Okay, the shooting guard on this team is a rookie. If the Jazz win three more games, there has not been a rookie who's led his team in scoring that's won more than 43 games since David Robinson. The small forward is Joe Ingles, who got cut by three different franchises and most recently by the LA Clippers. And they're playing two bigs, which everyone says you can't do.
Yeah, at least a limited amount per game. But yeah, I mean, that's... I always liked the favors Gobert combo until this year when it was ineffective to start the year, but it seems to have come around some way. Those are all reasons.
I'm piling on just because I'm trying to prove a point.
Those are all...
Like Ricky Rubio's shooting.
These are all reasons.
Those are all true, right?
Right. These are all reasons it's unlikely. So,
right.
So Gobert being really good, that's one. What else is it? What else has led to this incredible stretch?
Well, some of it, I think, is Coach Quinn Snyder's system. I mean, the Jazz defense, when Gobert's been off the floor, has been under 100 points per possession, too. Now, it's been like 92 when Gobert's on the floor, which is just an insane number. And maybe at that point, you've just been so discombobulated, you don't regain your rhythm when Gobert leaves. But the consensus that I've come up with is kind of what I said earlier, that I just think Rudy Gobert's got an impact on the game that's every bit the same as what James Harden and Steph Curry's impact on the game. And it's the only way to explain it to me, because if you told me LeBron's team won 21 of 23, I'd say, okay, I got it. And if you told me Steph's team won 21 of 23, I'd say, oh, okay, I got it. If you told me James Harden's won 21 of 23, yeah, it makes sense. So how is it possible? You can't win 21 of 23 by being fortunate. It's just too long a period of time in this league. You can win seven straight, but not 21 of 23.
Yeah, I mean, that's over a quarter of the season there. And I think, obviously, when Gobert has played it and been healthy, they've been an elite defensive team for a long time. And I thought, you know, it seemed possible to me that this was a team that could be a top five defense. They've been well beyond that, obviously. They've had some stretches similar to this, you know, when Gobert ascended to the starting lineup in that 14-15 season. I think they had a relatively similar stretch to this one, albeit in a lower offense environment at that time. And the offense has been better than I expected. drafted. I mean, I thought this was, they were headed towards being a bottom five offense. A lot of that was, you know, I had no idea that this dude they drafted number 13 was going to be this good.
Sure. He hasn't been particularly efficient recently. So the thing that, all right, so here's my next food for thought. Is there a chance that a coach is, the general premise in the league is that if a coach has a good defensive system, his team will be all right defensively. And if he has good offensive player, if he has good players, that they'll be good offensively, right? You'd agree with that, right?
Yeah, I would say the general consensus
that's the general thesis,
is that coaching has more of an effect on defense than offense.
Okay, so Mike Malone, when he went from Golden State to Denver, was thought of as defensive coach.
Yeah, although I don't know
Thibodeau's
thought
of as defensive
coach. I don't know
how
much evidence there actually was to support that. He talks tough, but that I don't know that he ever has helmed a great defense.
Okay, though Sacramento was decent with him defensively, I believe.
I thought they were middle of the pack. I'll look that up while you're talking.
Okay. Minnesota was supposed to be great defensively because of Tom Thibodeau. They're terrible. Steve Clifford's known as one of the better defensive coaches. They're bottom 10%, bottom 10 in the league, I think, defensively. Maybe they've moved up to 18. So wait a sec. Maybe it's the exact opposite, that you can take Ricky Rubio, who's got the worst shooting numbers of any player, frankly, in the last 30 years, a rookie, Joe Ingles, Derek Favors, and Rudy Gobert, and if you put them in an offensive system, they can become close to average. And if you have the personnel to play defense, you can be elite defensively. Like, maybe we have this backwards.
Well,
if you want to be elite defensively, you better have Draymond Green, Kawhi Leonard, or Rudy Gobert. Because Tom Thibodeau, or Joakim Noah in his prime. Because Tom Thibodeau, if I were to ask you when the year started who you thought the five best defensive coaches in the league were, you would have mentioned Thibodeau, you would have mentioned Steve Clifford, right, I think.
I don't know that I would mention either of those, actually, at the start of this
year. I don't know how you're not mentioning Thibodeau.
I
would have mentioned Budenholzer. They were the number two defense in the league last year. Right, but we all thought, but we didn't think it's because nobody has once said that Minnesota's not good defensively because Tom Thibodeau is not a good defensive coach.
By the way, in the full season of Mike Malone, the Kings were 23rd in defense, although that actually was an improvement for them with some of the surrounding seasons there. Yeah.
And I think when he got fired, they were all right. I mean, I actually think I was going up the year where they were fired. It's too hard for you to find out.
Yeah. I mean,
what they were when they were fired.
11.
I think they were middle of the pack when he got fired.
Yeah, I mean, but they finished 27th that season. So, and obviously Cousins missed time that
he left. So anyway, I don't know if this is true because I don't know it's true anymore. But so the question I'm asking is it possible that defense is actually more personnel based than offense? And that offense might actually be more system-based than defense at some level.
I think it may have moved more in that direction to some degree. I mean, I think we've compared to, you know, 10 years ago, I mean, we've seen teams that have really focused on moving the ball, getting system buckets, as I like to call them, more so than we saw 10 years ago, certainly 15 years ago. But I also think, I mean, you've seen teams that are pretty good defensively that don't have a ton of defensive talent. Like, take, for example, the Spurs this year. Kawhi Leonard has played 9 games. I think last I checked, they were the number 3 defense. And, you know, how many guys on their team do you look at as elite defenders at this point in time? Like, not that many. Not to be number 3 in particular. So that's one that pops out to me. And I think also, if you look at, you know, I think that coaching on offense, you know, you can get this Jazz team, which is, you know, has, as you mentioned, some spacing challenges. It doesn't have experienced individual creators off the dribble. You know, to get them to like 15 or 18, when maybe you would have said going into the year that on talent they might be 25th. You know, I think you can do that. Can you get, with just the system, a team from 15th to the top 5? I don't think you can. I think you got to have elite talent to be in that top 5. And that's, if you look at who the top 5 offenses were, and you've got some of the best individual superstars in the game on those teams.
I would 100% agree with that. But so then this leads to my next debate.
Okay.
I'm just going to throw them all at you.
Sure.
I think we always talk about, you talk about playoff basketball, this, and the idea of the two-way player. I've asked 20 coaches this question in the last 3 weeks, and I think 19 of them have answered it the same way. And that is, what's harder to hide, a bad defensive player or a bad offensive player? And all of them have said a bad offensive player. And I've asked them, what's more detrimental to you, a bad offensive player or a bad defensive player? And all 19 of the 20 have said an offensive player. I'm not sure that's true. The Jazz defensive rating this year, I'd have to check this, but when Joe Johnson's on the was on the floor was like 107.
Yeah, and he played a lot of his minutes without Gobert as well, as I recall. And I forget where they were last year. And Joe?
Probably because of the injury. Yeah. And Rodney Hood's was 107.
Yeah, and Joe hasn't looked too good in Houston either, to be honest.
Right. Andre Robertson is generally thought of as probably the worst offense player in the league, right?
Oh, there's got to be a few worse, but he's up there.
Rotation player. Oklahoma City, I don't have it in front of me, but Oklahoma City's offense, I think, is 3 points worse per 100 possessions when he's off the floor.
Yeah, and they obviously were much better on defense as well. I think...
Right, but let me make sure people got what I just was trying to show. The worst defensive players in the league, which are hard to figure out who they are. Like, that's actually the hardest thing I'm having in this research, is like, who are the 10 worst defensive players in the league? It's really, I can't get a consensus. But so I've chosen two I know that are bad defensive players. The team was 10 points per 100 possessions worse when they were on the floor. The worst offensive player is only 3 points per 100 possessions worse. Dirk is like 7 defensively. He's a pretty big number. Like, he's probably one of the worst defensive players in the league. I think they're about 7 points worse when he's on the floor. So suddenly I'm beginning to wonder, is it maybe even a bad deep? So then, like, this is just, I'm picking... I'm doing something conceptual with names on it. Don't necessarily pick apart the piece. But let's say Lou Williams is an elite level offensive player and a terrible defensive player. Fair?
Yeah, I think so. He's definitely a liability.
Okay. Royce O'Neal of the Jazz is an incredible defensive player, and he's shooting 18% from three since the All-Star break. So he's a pretty bad offensive player.
Yeah.
Like, is their value the same? Is their value to the game? It's always been thought that Lou Williams' value is way more. I'm not sure I think that's true anymore.
Well, this is actually, I would go back a little bit to the playoffs, and I'd also go back to Houston, actually. I think Houston, to me, with their switching scheme, has done an unbelievable job of not guarding the people who don't need to be guarded. And so when you get into these mismatches, they have always got the lane clogged, and they can always bring help, and you're not really able to ever get them in rotation in a way that they don't want to be. That's just one example. But I do think in playoff basketball, not having guys who can't shoot and aren't a threat, that's when that really locks in a little bit more. Because I think you have to be kind of more disciplined about not guarding guys than you do, oh, well, we'll just put this guy who's not a good pick and roll defender in the pick and roll, or we'll try and get him switched onto our best player. I do think, though, that with your bad defensive player, the success, number one, that we've seen Cleveland have going after Steph Curry, that we've seen Houston have going after whoever the hell they want to go after with James Harden, whatever position they are on the floor, you know, maybe that's starting to switch a little bit. And maybe especially now with the additional spacing that's on the floor, you know, it used to be, all right, ISO is not very efficient. Well, we've seen teams be able to be efficient now with that again, and maybe that's due to the fact that there's so much more spacing on the floor. Maybe that has finally been the antidote to these Thibodeau overload style defenses. And so it maybe, I would certainly agree with you to the extent that I think it has shifted back in that direction of being able to take advantage of bad defenders one-on-one in a way that maybe you weren't able to do, you know, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, when teams were playing two bigs and it was just too easy to bring the help.
And then the next question is it possible that having a defensive stopper actually might be more valuable than having an offensive point score?
Well, I actually think the defensive stopper, the individual defensive stopper, I'm going to lock you down one-on-one guy, may be less valuable than it's ever been, just in terms of individual, I can stop you in an ISO defense because, all right, they'll just run a pick and roll and get that guy off of your guy.
Okay, and switching, right?
Yeah. I've yet to see the team. The Warriors have come the closest. They had some success with this, for example, against Cleveland last year. And they were able to hold down Cleveland to some degree in some games in that 2016 finals. But I've yet to see the team that really can consistently either avoid, you know, they'll try and hedge with like a guy like Curry. And, you know, that means the guy just gets downhill right in the lane. I saw it last night with Houston and Portland. Or they'll end up having to get switched eventually anyway, and you got to hope that you ran down enough time that there's not enough time to do damage. I really, when they go after those small pick and rolls to get the matchup, I've not really seen the team that's been able to play really effective defense against that to avoid getting either an ugly matchup or your guy going downhill because that small ineffectively tried to hedge and it didn't really work.
It's worth keeping an eye on. I think you're probably accurate on that. But
and maybe in the playoffs, teams can drill that a little bit more and try to avoid it, which they wouldn't necessarily in the regular season. But I mean, that's why this playoffs to me is just going to be so fascinating, especially if Houston and Golden State match up and those games are close going down to the end. That's just going to be so incredibly fascinating to me.
You watch the Warriors every day. Do you think they're vulnerable?
Well, they got to get healthy. We're going to assume they're healthy.
Yeah.
I think they have some vulnerabilities in that I'm not sure that Draymond Green is quite the same player. He's had some nagging injuries this year. He's an undersized guy getting into his late 20s, may not quite be the athlete he was a couple of years ago, just from a pure run jump athleticism standpoint. And I think also their lack of three-point shooting outside of their big three guys, Klay, Steph, and KD, could end up being an issue as well. Iguodala at least has started playing better. You know, that's another potential vulnerability. But yeah, I mean, if you look at this regular season, I would say so. But I think they're more vulnerable just because Houston is so good. You know, I think that's the biggest thing that sticks out to me. But it's also worth noting that they're 40-10 with Steph Curry in the lineup this year, which is still pretty damn good. That's a 65 win pace.
Right. I mean, as much as they're struggling, they're what, 4 games behind the Rockets, who have been unbelievable?
Yeah.
Or whatever it is now. I don't know what it is. But, you know, you just mentioned something on Draymond. I haven't thought about this. So I have a, people like to pretend that measurables don't matter. And I totally believe the other opposite. That measurables completely matter, both in the NFL and the NBA. And my theory on it is that it is possible to succeed in the league as a undersized player, but your attrition rate, I don't know if what the phrase I'm looking for is, but instead of aging naturally, you fall off the cliff. So Carlos Boozer went from viable player to out of the league. When players are just, they're great, you know, they're still, I mean, Carlos Boozer was unbelievable 2010 guy but when he was at all off, then all the aspects of him being undersized kicked in. I think we're seeing it a little bit with Millsap.
Yeah.
Although he's going to age a little faster than other
players. I disagree with you on that. I mean, he had some of the best seasons of his career at like 30 and 31, which is, I mean, that's already supposed
to be past the belt. Yeah, but go look. I haven't looked at Paul this year. Paul's year last year in Atlanta is not right.
No, I mean,
if you kind of just go look at all the aging numbers, there's a pretty steep decline that may be going on.
Oh, no, I agree.
So it's interesting. Draymond would fit into that is that if he's at all off, his level of performance drops more significantly than somebody who's right-sized for their position.
I think you're right about that, although I think you're being unfair to Millsap because, you know, I think the idea would be that, you know, by 29 or 30 he would have a significant drop-off, and at 32, you know, that's when most players are going to fall off. I think he actually has aged better than the typical player, but I think in general you probably have a point. But that's something I would kind of want to study. I think it's one of those things that, like, just anecdotally maybe I'm not ready to believe, but just watching Draymond this year, especially offensively, you know, as a finisher with his burst, the three-point shooting hasn't been there. I don't know if that's age or what, but that's been a concern, and they run a lot of stuff through him, and he's declined enough to where I think, oh, maybe they would be better off running more stuff through just their main guys, but then you've got nobody guarding Draymond is kind of the problem. So, but I mean, again, this is very much nitpicking, and it's much more about, well, the Rockets have lost whatever it is, 2 games all year that Harden, Paul, and Capella finished, as opposed to the Warriors aren't any good. All right, let's take another quick break here, and we'll bring David right back, talk a little bit more Utah Jazz to finish up right after this. Keep having the bad luck that Danny is not on these podcasts where we have reads for Stamps.com, because he is an avid Stamps.com user. I've certainly used it, of course, since this podcast is a small business. I use it in my personal life as well, especially for those pesky returns. We all get stuff mailed to our house now, and it's kind of a pain to go to the post office and return it compared to simply having someone pick up your postage with Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail, from postcards to envelopes to packages, domestic to international. Do you say envelopes or envelopes, by the way? I think I say envelopes. I might be inconsistent. That's not good. But what is good is Stamps.com, and Danny has used it a ton because he's actually mailing out a bunch of copies to his friends, family of his book. You just use your own computer and printer, click, print, mail, and you're done. Stamps.com makes it really easy. They also send you a digital scale even, which calculates exact postage for you. They'll even help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. No need to lease an expensive postage meter, and there are no long-term commitments. Right now, you too can enjoy that Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. The way to get started with them, go to Stamps.com. Right at the start, just click on the microphone. You don't wait until checkout. You just do it right at the beginning. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage. You type in that familiar CapSpace code. Easy to remember. We talk about CapSpace all the time in the program. That's Stamps.com. Enter code CapSpace right at the start and let them know that you came from us. So last week, we did our top 10 players in the NBA. And you've been making the argument, in part predicated on what you've been saying already, that you think that Rudy Gobert is a top 10 player. So I'm going to read you my top 10 guys in the league. You tell me which of those guys you would have Gobert over and why. Is that a fair exercise? Because this is always the thing, right? When people are like, oh yeah, you know, this guy should have made the All-Star team. All right, well, who are you leaving out? You know, that's always my question on that, right? And this is...
I can't be Dick Vitale and have 75 guys in my tournament?
All right, so I'm going to go down the list. You tell me when I get to someone that you think Rudy Gobert is at the same level at. LeBron James, James Harden, Steph Curry, Kevin Durant. That's my top four, tier one.
No problem.
Tier two, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Anthony Davis.
Let's talk about Giannis a little bit.
Yeah, okay.
What's their record?
Not as good as the Jazz.
So I love Giannis, and I think that I've almost never seen anything like it. And I can absolutely understand. I mean, I most people are like, what the hell are you talking about right now? I'm with you, but let's talk about it.
I think this is a reasonable one, actually, because I think Giannis has some flaws in his game.
And so I think that Rudy is better defensively than Giannis is offensively. By a large margin, actually. And then I think Rudy has an offensive impact in the game because I believe dunkers are really important and they have gravity toward the rim. And Giannis is really good defensively. So Giannis is probably a little bit better than Rudy. Giannis's defense is probably a little bit better than Rudy's offense. And I think Giannis is terrific. Please don't misinterpret it. But I think it's a worthwhile discussion. I don't know what the answer. I don't know necessarily what the answer on that is. I mean, we're talking about a guy and all the traditional numbers on Giannis are so mammoth at 27, 10, 5, and 2, and 2, that it seems absurd to be even thinking about it. But I'm not sure that I would tell you that I actually think Rudy Gobert has more impact on the game than Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Well, and it's interesting, too, when you say has more impact on a game, you know, is that the same as a better player? Is that the same as a more valuable player? You know, those are interesting questions as well, right? But let me ask this. Do you think that
let me throw out one other note. I may be underselling Giannis's defensive impact.
I mean, if
their defensive system is so weird and their defensive numbers are so weird, but if I recall correctly, when I prepped for Milwaukee, which was quite a while ago, they're considerably better when Giannis is on the floor defensively than when he's off the floor.
Oh yeah, so they fall apart without him on both ends. They've been, you know, I think they're like probably plus five or something with him per 100, and then they're well into the negative without him.
So Giannis and Rudy, I think, are legitimate discussion.
Well, so let me ask you this question. One of my core tenets in coming up with my list was that I believe that offense, when push comes to shove, is more valuable than defense. Now, part of that, which to some degree Gobert and the Jazz, at least during this recent stretch, have refuted to some degree, is that generally the best offensive teams are more extreme from league average than the best defensive teams are. And that hasn't been the case in this recent run with Gobert. Now, you know, I think they've gotten a little bit lucky with opponent three-point shooting. I think it's, you know, it's like below 30% or something during this run. It's pretty low, right? Or am I misremembering that?
Above the break is, but even if you normalize, they're so much better than everybody else defensively. Even if you normalize the opponent three-point shooting, they're still 5 points, 6 points better than the next closest team.
Okay, but so that's five.
Right now, they're, I mean, let's make sure everybody understands. You know, I'm not playing the, oh, nobody pays attention to the Utah Jazz crap. I don't believe that. I actually think the Jazz have been like more covered than any team ever that's seventh in their standings this year with Donovan and Rudy. The Jazz are 9 points better since, I think, January 19th than the second best defensive team in the league.
Yeah, and Houston is like, you know, 8 points better or something like that better than the second best. Yeah, okay, so, right.
That's the second best, not better than average. Like, the Jazz are at like 94 and Toronto's at like 102 or 103. So even if you normalize the three-point shooting, the Jazz are at 98 and they're still the second best team's at 102.
Yeah, so
it's incredible.
Yeah, that is completely insane.
The defensive dominance is, and even in the game they lost to Atlanta, the defense was like a 95. But let me give maybe give a little background on what the Jazz defense has done, which I am giving credit to Rudy, so that people don't think I'm totally insane.
Is that fair to put that all on Rudy Gobert?
I think so. Okay. I mean, I really do, just considering how bad the defense was without him for so much of it. But so in 21 of the last 24 games, the Jazz have held their opponent under 101 points per 100 possessions. When you do that, you win 80, that's 6 points below league average. You win 83% of your game. In 33 of the 45 games that Gobert has played this year, the Jazz have done that. 33 of 45.
Yeah, that's...
In the last 20, the defensive rating is like a 93, and the league average is 106, 107.
So another argument that I had was, it's easier to find a reasonable facsimile of Rudy Gobert than it is Steph Curry or James Harden or LeBron James.
I couldn't disagree more strongly. Because what, DeAndre Jordan? But the Clippers have never been this good defensively.
Yeah, I mean, DeAndre Jordan is not that great overall. I mean, I think.
Right, but like, what are you going to find that's a reasonable facsimile of a guy who's got a 9'7" standing reach and a 7'9" wingspan? Like Dikembe Mutombo, but it's been 15, 20 years since we've had one of those.
Well, you could say Joel Embiid would be a reasonable facsimile. I mean, not that he is exactly particularly ubiquitous in his own right. But then
James Harden is my Steph Curry. Just as easily I can find Steph Curry, I'm finding James Harden. The best offensive player in the league is still Steph Curry, and the second best is Durant and Harden. The best defensive player is Rudy, and the second best might be Embiid. I would agree with that concept, but I don't think you can find a reasonable facsimile of Rudy Gobert at all.
Yeah, I guess my point would be you can find someone who could block some shots and protect the rim. They might not be as good as Rudy is,
but that's not what he does. But that's not what Rudy does. Teams take 8% less shots in the restricted area than they do when he's off the floor, than league average. Not even when he's off the floor, just league average.
Do you know how that compares to other, to other big men? Is that just like way beyond?
I have not done that.
I'd be very interested to know that. Actually.
I have not. I mean, I could probably go do it at some point. I have not done it. But irrelevant of how it compares to other big men, the Jazz shot composition defensively is as much a reason why they're elite defensively as teams missing shots, if that makes sense. So when Gobert's on the floor, 3.5% of shots are corner threes. But the league average is 7%. When Rudy's on the floor, teams don't get shots in the restricted area. League average is 32% of shots in the restricted area. When Rudy's on the floor, 26.5% of shots are taken in the restricted area.
Yeah. Actually,
so when Rudy's on the floor,
these are numbers we have discussed,
you're moving,
by the way, on the pod. I hope you, thanks to Liam Doyle, who grew up a big Jazz fan, who's our intern. He made sure on our last 15 and 60 that we marched through all these numbers. So I think the audience is familiar with it. I hope about how he really changes the shot profile for opponents, basically, which is kind of
But I would argue he changed the shot profile. He's moving 10% out of shots out of the most valuable areas into the least efficient areas, and I think that's no different than what James Harden does offensively.
So another reason that I felt like I wasn't as high on Gobert is I feel like against the absolute best offenses in the playoffs, the teams that can run high pick and roll, where he's got to really get out on the floor, where they can space him out with a center who can shoot the ball, or they're going to go small against him and force him to guard the three-point line more. My thought was, and my rankings were, if you want to win a championship, these are the players that you would want on your that Rudy, at the very least, to me, I have some skepticism. He hasn't perhaps had a chance to show it yet, but I have a lot of skepticism of, can he be effective against the top four best teams in the league the way he is against the other 26 who don't have that type of talent to really stretch him out defensively?
Are you taking James Harden off your list because he couldn't beat Kawhi Leonard?
I don't know that was necessarily the case last year, that it was Kawhi Leonard in particular. But I mean, regardless of whether that's a reason to have him out of the top 10.
But I mean, I think some of the best offensive players have awfully tough times in the playoffs against some of the best defensive teams.
Sure.
Minnesota is a very difficult matchup for the Jazz defense and Rudy Gobert because Karl Anthony Towns pulls him outside, but so's Kawhi Leonard for James Harden.
Well, just regardless of whether that's a reason to have him lower on this list, is that a valid criticism? Do you think that he is less effective against teams like that?
Sure. I mean, a five that pulls him out, I mean, can have a huge impact, but the next guy you're going to mention is Anthony Davis. And
yeah, he's done well.
Anthony Davis had a brilliant game against the Jazz last time, but in the seven games prior to that, Anthony Davis shot below four, and even in that game where he's brilliant, Anthony Davis has shot 40% against the Jazz in the last eight games he's played against.
I'm more concerned about guys who he can't drop on the pick and roll, like a Steph Curry, the way Harden is shooting the ball this year, KD, guys where if you run a pick and roll and Gobert is back in the paint, it's just going to be a three. That's more what I'm concerned about than the shooting center necessarily.
Yeah, but I don't think I'd have to have a Jazz going to defend it. So
you think he can trail get out that on
pick
the floor?
And, you're going to trail that pick and roll and play behind him and try to move that player into the... I mean, I don't think your criticism... I'm not telling you that I think that you're inaccurate in saying that that style of player can cause some problems. Now, I will point out that Portland, who would fit a little bit of what you're talking about, in their last two games against the Jazz, offensive ratings have been 97 and 100.8.
Yeah.
So the Warriors, the last time they played the Jazz, had an offensive rating of 95.9. Like, that's probably the Warriors' worst offensive game of the year. So, you know, Miles Turner should fit that a little bit. Indiana's offensive rating is an 89.9.
Yeah. Although Turner himself was very effective in the playoff circle.
Fine. Right. But, Anthony Davis in New Orleans should fit. Their last one was 97.3. So I agree. I, to some extent, might buy what you're saying. I just think I think the same thing is true for the best offensive players struggle in certain lineups as well, and I'm not sure you're holding them to the same standard.
Yeah, that's a reasonable point. This has been interesting. And just for the record, by the way, some of the other guys I had.
By the way, I'm pulling up Portland against the Jazz earlier. She was a 92.9. Yeah. Like, I'm dreading the idea of the Jazz playing Portland in a playoff series, and then I'm looking at the Portland hasn't had an offensive game over 100 points for possession against the Jazz yet this year.
Let's talk about that, actually. That's what I wanted to transition to, is of the teams that are 3-8 in the West right now, obviously, you know, if they get 7 or 8, which is a distinct possibility, you know, they got to play Golden State and Houston. Neither of those are palatable matchups, obviously, for anybody in the league. But if they can get out of the 7-8, New Orleans, OKC, San Antonio, Portland, Minnesota, of those teams, are there any that you think are better matchups for the Jazz? Or are there anything that they might struggle with a little more?
You're going to hate me and the listeners are going to hate me. I'm just not going to go down that road until they get in.
You're worried that
Sorry.
They may not even make it?
I'm not at all convinced the Jazz are making the playoffs.
And, I mean, certainly the projection systems. I know the Clippers won a game they probably weren't supposed to win tonight. The Jazz had that unexpected loss against the Hawks, but Jazz 85% playoff odds according to 538 and Clippers 27%.
Those projection systems have two flaws to them, in my opinion. Yeah. And I'm sure the 538 people will tell me I'm wrong because Nate Silver and those people are way smarter than I am. But here are my two things I think are wrong with these systems. One is that it assumes you'll play the final 12 games of the season the same way you played the previous 70, which is not true, right? You're going after every single one of these at a much higher level than you did the previous 70. And two, I don't know if I can explain this, but the reason the Jazz chances are 85% is because they have a pretty easy schedule. But with only 11 games left, if you drop one of those, like the Jazz just did, you don't have any room to make it up. Whereas the Clippers' chances are 30-whatever% because they have a bunch of tough games, but they're actually home for a lot of those games, and they're probably like 50-50 games. They're going to win more than 50% of their 50-50 games coming down the stretch here. So I actually think the Jazz are going to have to get to 47 wins to get into the Western Conference playoffs. And then I think it's going to depend on who they get tied with at 47 wins of whether they get in or not.
Yeah, so that...
I think Denver might be in a little bit of trouble. Denver's the only one I don't feel great about.
Well, so
right
the
now.
Clippers...
Yeah. But they got a huge win tonight.
The Clippers are 38-33, so they would need to go 8-3 the rest of the way to get to 46 wins. That's asking a lot.
It is asking a lot, but I actually think I think they'll be favored probably in 8 of those games. So it's a doable thing. It's a lot.
I haven't checked their schedule that closely.
But I'm not going to talk about which match. First of all, if our head coach ever heard that I did that, he'd kill me. So I'm just scared of our head coach.
Well, don't worry. Nobody listens to this show.
Okay.
All right. Two more things I wanted to talk about. First one is Donovan Mitchell. I was totally unfamiliar with him. My buddy Mike Schmitz predicted him to be Rookie of the Year. I thought he was completely insane. You on Danny's show, you said he thought he was going to average 15 points a game. I forget whether you said that on my show too, but both of us thought that you were insane for saying that. Obviously, we were insane because he was awesome. I mean, the last time the 13th pick in the draft just came in and played like this, I've never seen it. So, number one, like, what is he so much better at now than he was in college? Because I mean, I wasn't that familiar with his tape in college. I mean, Schmitz obviously saw it, but you know, some other people saw it. lot, but it was difficult to imagine a guy who, you know, wasn't all that efficient as a college offensive player would be able to come in and score the way that Mitchell has.
So the one thing is, if you go back and look at his second run through the ACC, he actually, like, they play a December game at Conseco Fieldhouse against Indiana, and he gets benched. He actually got benched in his sophomore year, like, taken out of the starting lineup. I mean, that's – but if you go take his second run through the ACC, I think he averages close to 19 points a game. It's a lot. So that is consistent to this kind of just incredible learning and growth process that he's been on. I think, the obvious cliche answer is the NBA game matches him better. That's true. He worked really hard with Johnny Bryant, Lamar Skeeter, and some of the Jazz coaches on finishing, and he struggled at it early, and they learned how to finish at the rim, and he's been shooting about 65% in the restricted area, which is pretty fabulous.
I mean, and that's been, like, the shot that he has now, and number one, even though he can't jump off of 1 foot, he still finishes off of 1 foot, so he's able to at least extend outward a little bit. He's got those long arms. And then those scoop shots, those Nash layups, even off of 2 feet, you know, rather than going to a floater, he can still extend even off of 2 feet and get the shot around the defense. And those are the shots to me that have been so impressive.
Yeah, and I think even, you know, he had a tough night against Atlanta, but he even stopped in kind of a two-footed jump, pull-up jumper from 8 feet out on a few when he, as the game went on. I mean, I think he just has an incredible aptitude of learning as the game goes on, and that has been a huge part of it. Quinn Snyder has said that he's learned 3 years of information in 3 months. So to me, that's kind of who he is, and what is the essence of him is the learning that he's displayed on an incredible run. So that's been the super impressive part to me about who he is and what makes me believe he could be really, really fabulous.
At what point did you, like, start to believe that he had, like, this rookie of the year potential superstar type talent?
Boy, that's a... I don't know when I just, you know, when did I just suddenly, I mean, I think I have crazy thoughts about him. So, I mean, he's averaging 20 points a game.
What are those crazy thoughts? Let's hear him.
20%. I mean, I think he can score 30 points a game. Yeah. I don't even think it's a stretch. He's scoring 20 points a game right now, and he's shooting 28% on the above the break three for the last 20 games.
Yeah, and as you've noted, the off the dribble three-pointer is not quite there yet for him.
Right, but they're going to be there. Like, I have no doubt that those are going to be there. I don't know if it's going to be by October of next year or whether it's going to be, you know, shortly thereafter. The night against against New Orleans was pretty incredible when he dropped 41. But there were really just a bunch of little, that's such a demonstrative, obvious moment. And that was December 1st.
We went to dinner in Summer League.
You know what, actually, I'm going to go to this one.
To dinner in Summer League and pretty high on him at that point, even I recall.
Yeah, I thought he was pretty good. The night, actually, that I'm going to go to is December 5th. The Jazz play at Oklahoma City, and he's guarded by Andre Robertson and Paul George the entire night and finished with 31 on 22 shots.
I remember that game.
And I was like, and we lost that game, but I was like, it's over. Like, it's incredible. Like, this is, and he didn't wilt. And then there was a bunch of weird stuff that was going on where there was a whole portion of time where the players of other teams were going up to talk to him after the game, which sounds like a really weird thing, but players don't do that. Like, players like Chris Paul, who does have a tie to him, and Russell Westbrook were, like, seeking him out after games to talk to him. And it was like, they clearly see, which is far more important than whether I can see it, they clearly see that this kid is remarkable. He's a great kid, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the nicest thing about him. Like, here's a story I'll tell about what a great kid Donovan. So Donovan got the flu during the season, and we all fly on the same charter. So when Donovan got the flu, what they do is they move Donovan to the back of the plane with the media so that he doesn't get his teammates sick, because they don't care if they get sick. And so Donovan's got his mask on. He's sitting in the back, and Donovan, and we're all getting on, and I mean, he's like puking and feels terrible, and, you know, all these things. And Donovan says, hey David, am I sitting in somebody's seat? And no, Donovan's all right. You're good. Just, you know, like here's this kid, like, worried about, like, am I intruding on someone? Like, yeah, I mean, you are, but, like, don't worry about it. Like, we're all good. Like, it's just an incredible, I don't know if that story tells it, just an awareness and a kind of who he is. You know, his teammates deserve a lot of credit that nobody got jealous with him. And then at the same time, he deserves a lot of credit because his communication with his teammates and they know his earnestness is such that he, they clearly are supporting him in everything he's doing.
that's actually a good transition to the last thing I want to talk about, which is the NBA schedule. People have been really on that for the last few years. Teams have been trying to rest more, but it's really come into focus a lot lately too, with two coaches taking leave of absences in part due to what seems like exhaustion. Essentially, Ty Lue has said that there's a report that, you know, part of why he's had such trouble is just not being able to get to sleep. He's going to bed at 9:30 in the morning when they get back from the road trip. I mean, you're with the team all the time. You know, you're one of the closest civilians, I guess we could say, who's actually, you know, traveling with the team. Obviously, you don't have to play in games or anything, but what is it like being a part of this NBA schedule if you're a coach? I mean, do you just never get any time off during the season? Like, how do they deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm pretty close with Quinn and spend a lot of time with him, and I think I get him in all of his moments of relaxation, and that's, you know, maybe an hour a night where he's not thinking about the next minute. And if we go to dinner, there's like always this moment of dinner where all of a sudden he's like, all right, I gotta go, like it's time, like, you know, he can see the clock ticking on how much preparation he has to do before the game starts, and the level of detail we talked about earlier. So I do think, and the it's an interesting thing though, like why it's tearing up. No disrespect to Steve Clifford or Tyronn Lue, like it shouldn't be tearing these guys up more than it should heart surgeons, should it?
Well, heart surgeons did it.
Right? Like if you know you got a big heart surgery, heart surgery the next day, shouldn't you be like having a hard time sleeping? And I mean, something's really out of whack.
Yeah, but a heart surgery
whether
is
it's
like
the media presence.
It's kind of the same thing every time. I mean, I don't want to discount heart surgery, but I mean, how many different kinds of heart surgeries can there be? There's not, you know, I mean, certainly there's a disease, but you're not. Heart surgery isn't necessarily competitive. You know, there's not somebody out there like trying to like push your scalpel aside when you're like trying to do the surgery.
Right. You know, I don't know what it is, but it doesn't. So I would say this, I don't know what it is, but being as close as I am, it doesn't surprise me at all.
I mean, I think it's more physical.
I don't have any of that stress. I'm 0-0. And I'm pretty tired, and there's some games where I haven't prepped it all the way just because I don't have the energy to prep it. And maybe if you're a head coach, you can't do that. And so you have to force yourself through that to be able to prep. And then if you're doing that, then you've begun to start to spiral.
I think also,
I mean, coughing up blood's pretty serious stuff.
It's also, I think, part of why it's so stressful is you have to stress, and you are in theory responsible for so many things that you do not actually have direct control over, and yet you have to worry about it.
Yep,
like that's got to be a very difficult feeling.
Yeah, it's a good way to say it. It's a really good way to say it. It's interesting. I mean, it's not good. And it's not, and I don't think it's going. I don't think it's going the other way. I mean. You know, and to compliment the coaches a little bit, I think what's interesting about it is it tells you that none of them are doing it for the money, because almost all of them have a guaranteed contract where if they got fired, they'd be making a buttload of money,
yeah.
Right? And so they're not like, well, fine, screw it, fire. They're obviously trying to not get fired because they want to win and they want to, you know, but they're also, you don't see any of like, fine, fire me, I'll just take my money. So,
yeah. Well, I could think of one example in Sacramento recently, but outside of that, that's right. You don't have to comment on that one. I think we can call it quits here. Thanks so much again for joining us from Dallas, Texas. And hopefully you can lay off the caffeine enough to get a decent night's sleep tonight.
I will do my best.
All right, man. Thanks again for coming on. And don't forget, you can listen to Locked On NBA 5 days a week. And also, again, I'll plug it. Josh Lloyd's Locked On Fantasy is the best podcast I know of for NBA fantasy dorks. Thanks again to David. And yeah.
And if I can plug specifically Adam Silver, his 11-minute sit down with Adam Silver is the Locked On NBA guest on this on the Thursday of this March 27th.
Oh wow, that was nice. How'd you get him?
Connections, baby. Connections.
Did he just happen to be in Utah? Was that what it was? Oh yeah, because he was there recently. He was saying like, oh, yeah, we really want to bring the All-Star game back. That's right.
Yes, so we sat down.
Yeah. All right, that'll be awesome. Looking forward to that.
What question would you ask Adam Silver?
That's tough actually, because I've had like at SBC he came in at one point. Larry got him to come in sports business classroom, which I'm involved in the summer league. You know, I've been in press conferences, and I've never really had. I guess the biggest thing that I would want to know is, has the league studied the idea of whether reducing the number of games would actually lead to a loss of revenue or not? Like, is there data on that? Because people always say, "Oh yeah, you know, we can't reduce the number of games because, you know, it's going to lead to a loss of revenue." Is that true? true? Is that really going to, if you had 58 games that you play each team twice over the same amount of time and you still have games every day, but each team plays fewer games, you know, would it make the TV product rarer and therefore they'd pay more and it'd all come out as a wash or not? You know, do we have the answers to that question, or is it just kind of, oh, less games, fewer games, that means that, you know, we have lower revenue, we can't do it? That would be the question I'd want to ask.
I don't want fewer games. I didn't ask that because I don't want fewer games because then I get paid less.
Well, if that's true.
I don't know if that's true, if I would get paid less, but I didn't ask. That's a good, great question.
Yeah.
The best question I thought I asked him. You want to hear the best question I thought asked him? If you're going to get involved in gambling, do you have to get rid of everything that incentivizes losing?
Well, that would mean getting rid of the whole draft.
Or at least the structure of it, yeah.
All right, well, we won't spoil it. I want to hear what he said, so I will listen to that tomorrow. All right, thanks again. I'm glad you plugged that because that was interesting. We'll talk to you all next time. Thursday night edition will be tomorrow. I don't know what we're going to do yet, me and Danny, but we'll come up with something good. We hope. Talk to you all later. Thanks again to Sonos for sponsoring today's program. Sonos lets you control music with your voice. You can play your favorite podcast, your favorite music via Sonos as well, all over Wi-Fi, not Bluetooth, but Wi-Fi, much more reliable. You can even have someone set up your Sonos speakers for free if you live in any major metropolitan area. Just order from Sonos.com, select up and running at checkout, and you can get 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com when you use the promo code DUNK10. That's promo code DUNK10. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions.